Hello and welcome to the Gambling Files podcast, as sponsored by those marvelous, marvelous people at Sporting Tech. I tell you what, the other day I was thinking to myself, I need to get me a nice little iGaming platform, you know, something that does everything I need it to do. Where can I go for such a thing? I thought, Sporting Tech, I thought. But anyway, I digress slightly. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, John Bruford. Sadly, Fintan Costello is living his best life in Australia. Probably red as a lobster. Probably been bitten by something poisonous by now, I would have thought. And if not, then why not, Fintan? You're letting the side down. The entire Northern Hemisphere wants to know how you've managed that so far. Hopefully he's eating a lot of barbecue and drinking a lot of beer. So we do have a really, really good episode this week. But I wanted to, first off, I just wanted to talk a little bit about, I've been thinking a lot about opening lines, not because my intro to this is usually so, you know, patchwork, shameful is another word, but because I was watching something on TV written, I mentioned it quite a lot in this podcast, I think. I've been watching The Queen's Gambit on Netflix. I haven't finished it yet, but Walter Tevis, who wrote the book, is a tremendous writer. And it got me thinking about opening lines in books and really, really great opening lines. And I was thinking about how so often, like when you see a list of great opening lines, and there are a lot of lists out there because I just Googled it. I think very often the idea of a great opening line, it's retrospective. Because I'm just going to find a particular example if I can. Hold on. It's, crap, I can't find it now. Oh, there it is. Moby Dick, Herman Melville, written in 1851. The opening line, which this describes as probably the most famous of famous first lines, grabbing the reader's attention like a slap in the face. Right? I'm expecting a lot from this now, are you? The opening line is, call me Ishmael. I don't know about you, but my face remains unslapped. And this bizarre thing that I'm reading, which is on the Penguin website, who is this man who calls himself Ishmael, if indeed that is his real name? Who wrote that? God, I hope you're a shit. I hope you feel embarrassed. But anyway. But it did get me thinking, often opening lines, retrospectively brilliant. One of my all-time favorite opening lines is the book The Outsiders by S.E. Hinton, the book that kind of established the young adult field. And I still maintain it is a phenomenal book. It's pure melodrama. But the opening line, when I stepped out into the bright sunlight from the darkness of the movie house, I had only two things on my mind, Paul Newman and a ride home. I've always loved that line because it's kind of, it's mundane, but it's, yeah, I get that. You know, it's Paul Newman. He'd probably been watching The Hustler, which was written by Walter Tevis, who we've already just mentioned. So I was on Twitter the one day, and I follow S.E. Hinton, Susan Hinton, who wrote The Outsiders. And somebody had got that opening line tattooed on them, and it was actually done really, really nicely. And I thought, that's kind of cool. I mean, it's really wordy, but it's kind of cool. And they'd put the picture on Twitter. They tagged S.E. Hinton in it, and they were like, look, got your thing tattooed on my skin, you know, best opening line ever. And I just had to chip in and say, I'm really sorry, but it's not the best opening line ever. I think you'll find the best opening line ever is from The Haunting of Hill House by Shirley Jackson. And to my eternal surprise and wonder, S.E. Hinton chipped into my reply and said, he's right. So like that day was just like, I think I strutted around quite a bit that day. So the opening paragraph of The Haunting of Hill House, this is an opening paragraph rather than an opening line, because it is three lines. Get this. This is none of your fucking call me Ishmael. No live organism can continue for long to exist sanely under conditions of absolute reality. Even larks and katydids are supposed by some to dream. Hill House, not sane, stood by itself against its hills, holding darkness within. It had stood for 80 years and might stand for 80 more. Within, walls continued upright, bricks met neatly, floors were firm, and doors were sensibly shut. Silence lay steadily against the wood and stone of Hill House, and whatever walked there, walked alone. Unlike anybody who uses, for example, Sporting Tech's iGaming platform, which you'll never walk alone with, regardless of whether you support Liverpool. Neat little sidestep there. I don't think they saw that one coming. But no, seriously, mostly a great line. It's a retrospective thing. Which then got me thinking about records. Back in the day, the way that records were structured, albums, like music recordings, I might be wrong about this, but the opening single wouldn't be the opening track on the album. It would more often than not be track two. And I never could figure out why that was. If anybody out there knows, I'd love to be educated on that one. What else is new? So in the world of gambling, there's been some stuff happening. Kind of more of the same as usual, really. There's been some things happening in iGaming in Germany. We're joined by Michelle Hembury, returning to talk to us about what's going on there. And Michelle being her usual brilliant self. We also talked to Sharon Singleton and Roz Wade. Again, their usual brilliant selves. They're talking about mostly about what's going on in Macau at the moment and the lockdown of casinos there. And, you know, it's a big move. It's a huge move. But also, and I think, I don't know about you, but I'd forgotten this, but it's the first time the casinos have actually been closed since February 2020, I think. I think Ross says that in the interview. So that's, yeah, I guess we forget that in the way that the rest of the world's been locked down. And also China's approach to, you know, their kind of zero tolerance approach to COVID. It seems amazing that Macau has handled everything as well as it has and just had two deaths. And those were very, very recent and in very, very elderly people. So pretty amazing. What else is going on? Well, we've got Sporting Tech sponsorship. Did I mention that? I meant to. And we also have a lady on by the name of Julia Wilson from the Prohibition Wine Company. Now, this is genuinely really interesting. And I asked Julia on because I'd just seen something on LinkedIn or Twitter or somewhere. And I thought, actually, that is really interesting. She's talking about alcohol-free drinks, and basically grown-up alcohol-free options, but also how alcohol-free wine has evolved. And it's no longer like some grape juice. That it's made effectively in exactly the same way as wine is. And so it has all of the complexities of wine. And it's a very, very different product. And so for places with a restaurant, with basically with any F&B offering, you know, speaking as a non-drinker, it's a big deal. And more people are leaning towards that on a night out because, you know, getting pissed up is quite expensive. Not to mention it wrecks most of the next day, or it used to for me. So Julia's well worth listening to. Julia's our second guest today. Fintan, if you're listening to this, I'm not jealous because I'm currently sitting here sweating as though I was in Australia because most of Europe is enduring a very, very sticky heat wave. And it is pretty grim. I've got to be honest. It is pretty grim. But temperatures in the UK are supposed to hit a record high on Monday. Oh, holy crap. Do you know what I didn't share? It was my birthday yesterday, Tuesday, 12th of July. And my lovely ex, Fern, she brought the kids round. She brought the kids round to say happy birthday. And they brought me a present. They brought me a pressure cooker, which is quite exciting. I mean, if you're into that kind of thing. So I'm looking forward to giving that a go. I think they just want me to cook for them, but maybe. But unfortunately, Fern fell ill while she was at my house and then spent the evening throwing up and then had to take the kids home and sort them out. So Fern, if you're listening, I hope you're feeling much better now. And I hope you also noticed that I left out quite a lot of detail there. Happy birthday to me. I crashed my car at the weekend. That sucked. I was driving home from Pearl Jam and Pixies in Hyde Park. I dropped my stepdaughter Lorna off at her house, got some petrol, got back in the car. I was driving on a road I know very well. I wasn't speeding. Met a badger going around a bend and avoided the badger, but found the hedge. So I have a sneaking suspicion that the car is going to be written off by the insurance company. No car. Quite annoying. But anyway, I digress. Enjoy the podcast. Moving swiftly on to our first guest of this episode, we welcome back returning rock star German legal attorney, Michelle Hembury. Michelle is with the German legal firm Melchiors, which you or I being, well, me particularly being English and being particularly crap with other languages, Melchiors, yeah. Hello, Michelle.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me again.
It's all right. How's the weather in Germany?
Well, that depends what you're planning to do. It's quite warm, sunny. It looks beautiful from my perspective, but I'm not really taking the advantage of it at the moment. I'm sitting in my office, but it's nice to look at, though. That's good.
But you've got windows, so they must like you.
Yeah, well, I'm actually at home in my home office, so wow. I've taken the responsibility to create a wholesome and inviting atmosphere here, but I do feel comfortable. That's good.
You gave yourself a window. That's good.
Yeah.
Now, I would say, you know, you got to look out for yourself, you know, first and foremost. I don't mean at the expense of all others. I mean, simply in terms of, yeah, you kind of, you got to give yourself a pat on the back sometimes and say, you know what, you did all right, because nobody's actually going to do it for you. And I think giving yourself a window in your office is like, it's a big pat on the back.
Well, yeah, you could see it that way. Or you could just follow, I think, employment laws in Germany that say that you must have sunlight in your area where you're working, if possible, obviously. So yeah, but I do enjoy it. I like it a lot. I would also have a quite pretty office if I were working in the offices, but at the moment we're mainly in the home office situation.
I'm glad you added the caveat of if possible, because I was going to ask how that would affect the coal mining industry.
Oh, let's not go there.
Yeah, I mean, well, if it was in France, they'd be on strike already. Weather's good. You've been watching anything on Netflix?
Actually, yes. We've just finished the last season of The Crown, just for educational purposes of my partner and I. We wanted to be up to date for the new one, and we have been enjoying the series Borgen, which is a political series about, I would say, all the mayhems going on in Denmark, but it's fictional. So the basis is obviously reality, but the storyline itself is more so fictional. It's quite good. I don't think many people know of it, but it's a definite recommendation.
Sweet. I'm just finishing up. I'll probably finish tonight. The Queen's Gambit. Have you seen that?
Oh yeah, I love that one.
Mm-hmm. I think I'm just about to start the sixth episode, so penultimate episode. But yeah, it's excellent. It's interesting. It was written by a guy, or based on a book written by a guy called Walter Tevis. And Tevis most famously wrote a book called The Hustler and another book called The Color of Money, both of which were filmed. And The Hustler was one of Paul Newman's most iconic and least remembered, weirdly, films. It's a tremendous film, but it's in a similar vein. It is about genius, but not following a traditional path, for want of a better way to put it. It's a pool player who's ridiculously good and he tries to make his living by hustling. But it's not dissimilar, as bizarre as, and anybody that's seen it would probably say, Jesus Christ, he's lost his fucking mind. But in my head, it's reasonably, and he's a tremendous writer. He's got a real nice, it's kind of this economical but pulpy noirish kind of very hard to put your finger on kind of writer. But anyway, I digress slightly. Because I actually got here, so not to catch up on, are you watching The Crown? Did you watch season 4 of Stranger Things? Did you?
No, I didn't. I skipped that hype.
It was so good. I mean, it still is so good. And to actually ask you about, so there's been some stuff going on in Germany and there's been some stuff not going on in Germany. Now, obviously, Fintan is not here because he's living his best life in sunny Australia. Now, as you may be aware, Fintan is Irish, so I would imagine he's probably about the shade of a lobster as we speak. He did send me some messages of things to ask you.
Okay.
Which is good because me and, you know, he thinks up the questions. I'm just really the face. Anybody that's met me knows that that is, let's not even go there. Let's have a little bit of an, where are we at in Germany right now? Because we've gone into a heavily regulated iGaming kind of arena, and, you know, an awful lot of observers from the outside are looking at it and they're saying, this is a bad idea, this is a bad idea, this is a bad idea. People in on the regulatory side in Germany at the moment seem to have their hands over their ears and they're going, la 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 la. Where are things from your perspective?
I think they're slowly but surely coming to a proper basis. So we have now 3 regulators that are in the arena, as you said. And the third of those is the new Joint Gambling Authority, which is supposed to take up all the responsibilities regarding licensing as of next year. But they have started with one of their main responsibilities and tasks on the 1st of July, actually, which is all about the enforcement of the ban on illegal gambling, obviously. And that's, I think, was one of the biggest step stones in the past week or weeks or so. And then obviously the 2 heads of this new regulator, I think one of my colleagues, he always calls this authority the super regulator, because they're meant to be responsible for everything at the end of this year. So to combine sports betting and slot machine games and virtual casino and virtual poker games in one authority. But anyway, the 2 heads of this regulator, they had a digital or held a digital press conference last week. I think it was Friday, the 8th of July. And they just spoke a bit about what's going on, what their plans are, what they've been working on. And I think it was quite enlightening for the industry and obviously also us as legal advisors, just in regards of where they're heading, what the direction is and where their focus is lying on at the moment.
I see. So where are they? Actually, I'm not going to, we'll go into where they're heading in a minute. that enforcement kind of began July the 1st.
I would say that the responsibility for the enforcement of the ban on illegal gambling that started for this authority, but obviously there was a different authority responsible for the enforcement up until then. So it's not that illegal gambling or the ban on illegal gambling wasn't enforced at all up until then, you know.
Okay. But so they're supposed to be blocking illegal sites, right? Have they started doing that? Is that actually happening?
Yeah, so I think now you're are delving into the direction that they're going. What they mentioned during their press conference, actually, they did say So just to put it into context, they can, on the one hand, obviously forward operators or their names and domains to the police and other enforcement authorities, obviously, but they themselves can enforce, for example, IP blocking or payment service blockings, which they apparently have been doing, especially in regards to so-called second lotteries. So that's how you'd say it in German. Those are not actually lotteries. Those are when customers place bets on state-run lotteries. And those are illegal pursuant to our law, which is mainly the Interstate Treaty on Gambling, which came into force last year in July. And they did say that they've been starting on those IP blockings, especially. So I guess, yes, they really do have concrete plans or specific plans that they've been following in the past few weeks.
Now, you went a bit lawyerese there. Is that a yes? They've started blocking them?
Yes, they did.
Okay.
So I don't know if the audience is familiar, but especially those second lotteries that I just spoke about were run by the Lottoland domains and entities. So those apparently have been blocked, which is what the two heads of the new authority have mentioned during their press conference recently.
Okay. A question from Finton. He wants to know what the status on licenses are, because there's only a couple, I think, being issued so far, which, you know, seems a bit slow.
Yeah, that's a good question that Finton sent over, because obviously we in Germany, we don't only recognize virtual slot machine games and poker and casino games as gambling or games of chance, but also sports betting. And obviously there have already been many operators that were licensed to operate sports betting on the internet previously. And most of those operators are now included in a follow-up licensing procedure, you could call it, in order to be legally operating further after the end of this year, because their licenses are, they expire at the end of this year, I could say. But on the other hand, and I think that's what the focus was that Finton had in mind when asking this question, regards the slot machine and online poker licenses. Casino obviously is a completely different issue again here in Germany, but it's correct. I think they, at the time that we speak now, there have been three licenses actually issued to slot machine operators for the virtual space, which is slow. I think it's now 11 months after the interstate treaty that I mentioned came into force last year in July, and after the licensing procedures were starting to properly pick up. So it's almost a year after the authority took up their responsibility. So yeah, I do know that there are many more licenses in the pipeline, but obviously it's not that easy because there are several steps included after you submit your application. There are usually follow-up questions from the side of the regulator, and then you have to be approved of by the gambling committee, who is, I would say, a kind of regulator. it's a difficult position that they hold. And then you also have to submit a bank guarantee or some form of security of at least 5 million euros. So that also takes up some time, just organizational time, obviously. So yeah, that's why it has taken quite some time until the first licenses have been issued, but it's starting, so that's exciting.
Yeah, I mean, It is exciting, but I don't know about you, but I mean, I'm looking at the way that things are progressing. It's everything just seems to have slowed right down, and not that much seems to actually be getting done. It's like there's a lot of talk about getting stuff done, but not a lot of actual doing.
You could see it that way, but I do try to remain optimistic. And at least we do have some licenses. I think the regulator, I mean, we'd have to cut them some slack. Those people who have been now working on those licenses, they are somewhat inexperienced. They are properly understaffed at this authority. And mind you, the state administrative office, who have been responsible up until now and until the end of this year for the slot and poker licenses, they are only a interim authority until the new super regulator, as we called it here, the joint gambling authority, takes up all their responsibilities as of next year. That was planned to happen last year in July, parallel to the new interstate treaty came into force, but that just didn't happen. So there have been a lot of transitional periods crossing each other and affecting responsibilities and the effectiveness of their work. So it is a complicated procedure. It's heavily regulated. And it is fair to say that there's enough room for criticism, I think. But I think we'd do well if we just speak about or maybe discuss constructive criticism and looking into the past, saying, I don't know, it's taken too long until now. That won't make the future licensing procedures go any quicker, I think.
Well, that's me told. I mean, you're right, of course, but I guess, I mean, speaking from the outside, it's very hard to look at what's happening in Germany and feel positive about it. When we've kind of got what appears to be thus far an ideal regulatory setup in terms of tax level, in terms of oversight, in terms of everything, that where in Ontario they've kind of taken everybody else's mistakes on board and said, do you know what, we could just get it right. And yet we've got we've got whole countries, Sweden and Germany being the obvious choices, who seem to be ignoring the lessons that Ontario has taken on board and saying, well, you know, we'll just do what we think. I'm not being super negative. I'm just really struggling to be positive.
No, yeah, I understand completely where you're coming from. But let's put it that way. It's not only the regulator who has to learn from, let's say, successes, but also mistakes of other jurisdictions and other regulators. It's also up to the industry to communicate the practical relevance of regulations from their point of view. And you did too, but I also attended the IGB last week in Amsterdam. And I had a very interesting conversation with a CEO and founder of a game provider who obviously have immense difficulties to create games that are probably legal under the German restrictions at the moment. It's quite difficult, obviously, because you can't see into the future how the regulator will interpret certain restrictions. So you have to kind of wiggle your way around. But she also said it's not only upon the regulator to understand, because as I've said, they are understaffed and in some forms inexperienced. So I think what needs to happen here is constructive dialogue between the parties, between legal advisors, between the operators, between other involved parties like game providers and the regulator, and obviously other authorities taking care of, I don't know, gambling addiction prevention, whatever, protection of minors, and so on and so on, to really get them to one table and discuss what actually happens if, for example, a game a slot game is not allowed to spin longer than so-and-so seconds, or you're not allowed to stake more than a euro or so on and so on. So what is the consequence for the market, especially in light of the high tax rate that we now see since last year in July as well? I think that's the main point here, because I do hear from the industry a lot of frustration, a lot of misunderstandings, a lot of resignation even sometimes in regard to what the regulator does. And then, I mean, by no means the regulator has been doing some mistakes maybe, and I think they should, I mean, and that's what I mean, the dialogue is, I think, what helps both sides to come together and to find a constructive path, because at the end of the day, everyone, all of the operators who are interested in being licensed, and the regulator, and obviously the population, have a huge interest in a higher channeling rate towards the legalized market, because a licensed operator won't make any profits if the black market is still so successful, and obviously do not have to recognize any restrictions because they're obviously from the black market. So we all have an interest to form a proper white market and discuss going along the way, discuss the consequences for the practical market or side, the industry.
I can see why you gave yourself a window. Michelle, is there anything else regarding Germany that we need to discuss, do you think?
I think what was also important to say was that during the digital press conference of the heads of our new super regulator, was that they said they would focus their enforcement now mainly on those operators that clearly have no interest in participating in the legalized market. And I don't know if you recall, but I have mentioned in, I think, my first visit on your podcast that we are still facing some form of transitional regime, just because we have this new interstate treaty, we have several regulators, we have operators that already are licensed, some that are still remaining in their licensing procedure, others facing post-licensing tasks, and so on and so on. There was always this big question mark of, would the new authority also focus their enforcement on those operators who are willing to comply with the interstate treaty, who are already complying, who are being tolerated up until now, but are still under legal terms from the side of the regulator considered, and I'm not saying I agree with this view, but are still considered to be operating illegal games of chance, just because there's no license at the moment, but they are in their licensing procedure, so they have submitted an application of substantial value. And I think this was one of the main findings of this press conference, that the regulator says, no, okay, we are focusing our efforts, our time, and obviously money, on those operators who are not willing to comply, who are still remaining on the black market, who have not submitted a substantial application. And I think that was also a good starting point from our side, from the industry side, I'd say, because there seems to be a kind of mutual understanding where we are all heading, or where we want to head. We want to head to a higher channeling rate. We want to diminish the black market. We want to create a safer gambling environment for customers, because let's face it, people want to gamble. If it's online or in land-based casinos or whatever, there's an interest. So we have to create an environment that makes it safe for them.
Yeah, fair enough. I'm not going to argue with you. Mostly because I know better than to argue with you. So you mentioned, I think, earlier that you were at the event in Amsterdam last week.
Yeah, I was. I enjoyed it a lot. I actually was moderating a panel, which was my first time ever moderating a panel or speaking in front of an audience of in the gambling industry. So it was exciting, and it was not only exciting, it was also interesting, because obviously the preparation for a panel really gets you involved into the topic, because you want to be alert enough and focused enough on whatever everyone is saying. But then again, you don't want to know too much about the topic, so not to create some form of stiff, staged conversation. I think it went really well with our panelists, and we had an interesting, I'd say, debate on how games, virtual slot machine games, can be created and modified even to comply with current German restrictions on them. So stake limits, deposit limits, spin limits, breaks and bans and whatever. So jackpot ban, no audio play, and so on and so on.
Wow. Your ascent into a rockstar gambling lawyer territory continues.
I mean, you're the one having a great podcast. I saw on LinkedIn that you have reached a certain number of subscribers now, and most of them are not relatives, I think you put it, which was quite funny. I had to laugh when I read that.
It is very true. I think there's some of Fenton's relatives. There's a couple.
That's okay. You need the support of your home base before you really shoot off into the rockstar fandom.
It's very, very true. But actually, do you know what? Speaking of rockstar fandom, right? This is a bit of a tangent, even for me, right?
Oh wow!
So I sort of gave myself a birthday present last week, I went with my stepdaughter. I still call her my stepdaughter, even though I've been with her mum for like 10 years. Because your parenting, it doesn't end just because somebody becomes an adult. She's like 26 now. And we went to watch Pearl Jam in Hyde Park, which was very good. And they had Pixies as the main support. And yeah, Pixies were incredible, actually. They played with a smile. I've never seen them do that before. But the cool part was, this is such a shit story. You're going to be so disappointed. So Mike McCready, the guitarist from Pearl Jam, he's a bit of a guitar god. And he played phenomenal on the night and did the whole solo, played behind his head and all that kind of stuff. But the Pearl Jam are actually playing two nights in Hyde Park, and we weren't there the second night. But I saw somebody put a photo on Twitter of Mike McCready. And it was a great photo of one of the huge screens by the stage where you could see McCready playing it quite clearly mid-solo. He's clearly rocking his tits off, right? And he's wearing a Bauhaus t-shirt. Bauhaus as in the band that you are, I do not doubt for one second, far too young to remember. But early 1980s, they're a bit of a goth new wave kind of a band. Their front man is a guy called Peter Murphy, and he is my stepdaughter's uncle.
Oh wow.
So McCready on stage was wearing a Bauhaus t-shirt, and I just thought, that's pretty cool. I mean, he doesn't know the family connection in the crowd, but and of course we weren't in the crowd that night. Would have been even better if he'd been wearing it on the night we were there. I mean, gosh, what was he thinking? I told you it was a shitty story. I told you it was tenuous, but I went ahead and told it anyway.
I know it fitted perfectly to what we were just saying. So you could also turn it around and say you've already got rock stars in your circle of, or wider circle of relatives. So it's only natural for you to take off now.
Well, we're going to have some music on the podcast, as like we're going to have some intro music and some outro music on future episodes, not on this episode because I haven't quite sorted it out yet. But an old friend of mine from sixth form is a musician. She's a singer and a musician. She's phenomenal, and she owns all of her publishing. And she's basically said that we can use any of her back catalogue that we want.
Wow. So
that's quite exciting. It's not rock, but I wanted something that, because, you know, when you listen to podcasts, they've always got the same, it's almost like news music, you know. This is the latest podcast news and all of that kind of shit. And I wanted something like almost operatic or something, just something that was completely nothing like that. And I think we've succeeded in finding that. I don't know when it's going to be. I don't know when it's going to actually be added, but I am pretty excited because I've wanted music since day one. But I wanted kind of like, oh, this is hard to explain.
Yeah, I understand. You wanted something original, something that would cause interest in the listeners or audience, but also not predict too much of what's coming.
Exactly. Something almost discordant in a way.
Hmm.
Without, you know, actually being discordant by the actual definition of discordant. Tonally discordant, I would say. No, thematically discordant rather than tonally discordant. I think it's probably the right way to phrase that. Michelle, thank you again for coming and joining us and sharing your rock star gambling lawyer in Germany brilliance. Always
yeah,
appreciate
well, thank you for having me. I always enjoy it a lot.
Well, thank you for setting the bar so, so low for your happiness. and congratulations on your window. I'm delighted. I've got a window here. Mine looks out on, so I rent office space from a company that they build equine arenas.
Mm-hmm.
And so it looks out on the yard where they keep all their stuff for building. So that's nice. But I can see some hills and trees in the background. So that's something, right? Anyway, digress. Queen's Gambit, great. And The Crown and Borgen, apparently. So look them up. And Netflix sponsorship opportunities are available. And we move to our probably second guest. We are joined by Julia Wilson of the Prohibition Wine Company. Julia, welcome. What's your title?
Thank you, John. Title, Dog's Body.
So you're the lowest rung of the ladder. Is there anybody senior there that I could talk to?
Most probably my dog. He'll give you plenty of information about how I make him come everywhere with me, and that's about it, really.
So your dog is not the dog's body. It's interesting.
No.
And there's like a big oxymoron going on there. What kind of dog have you got?
Black Labrador.
Wow. Now, often when I see a black lab, I usually say it's a dog for people that don't want a dog.
He is not the usual black lab. He doesn't eat. You have to coax him to eat. He will only eat steak and chicken if it's hand-fed to him, and sausages.
Jesus.
Yeah, he's like a king. He lives like a king. And then he goes for a 5-mile run in the morning round the reservoir and a 5-mile run in the evening round the reservoir. And he's looking at me now going, you're talking about me, Mum, aren't you? I know you are.
I think there's a lot of people listening to this that would be like, I need that life.
And I'm sure that if I gave him, you know, Prohibition wine, alcohol-free rosé, he'd love that as well. He'd just lap it up.
I like the way that you got your product in there. That was subtle.
Thank you.
Because we have a sponsor on the podcast now. We start last week was our first week with a sponsor. And I don't know about you, Julia, but I think my favorite iGaming platform provider presently is probably Sporting Tech. Have you got a favorite?
No, I'm afraid not.
Well, then you can choose Sporting Tech as well.
Okay, thank you very much. Well, I like my sport, so that's good. I'll have Sporting Tech.
Awesome. So... Prohibition Wine Company, right?
Yes.
Well, just broadly, what do you do?
So we import a sparkling wine. So we've currently got a sparkling rosé and a sparkling white that come in from La Mancha in southern Spain. It's traditionally produced as a cava. So it starts life out as a 12.5% vol. And then to de-alkalize it... the sorry, my dog saying hello. To de-alkalize it, the wine is put into a large vat where it is gently heated to evaporate the alcohol. And so it brings it down to a 0.0. So it is halal certified, it's vegan, and it's gluten-free.
Wow. That's good. Hang on. So it's gluten-free, halal. Was there anything else in there?
Vegan.
Vegan. Well, that is the all important one.
Yes. And we, very good friend Nigel Barden had the rosé on Simon Mayo's drive time. And Simon turned up his nose going, "What, I don't want to be tasting alcohol-free." And the feedback was, "Oh my God, I can't believe this is alcohol-free sparkling wine." So he got very good feedback. You cannot tell the difference. The nose is there. The bubbles are there. The taste is just as you would think drinking a cava, a prosecco, a champagne. It's got everything there. It just minus the alcohol.
So the all of the key kind of chemical interactions during fermentation, they all still happen, and then the alcohol is removed afterwards.
That's correct.
So, because a lot of alcohol-free drinks that are kind of supposed to be these grown-up alternatives, they do taste like shit. I don't even mean that in a good way for any fecophiles that are listening. I guess that process, including fermentation, that's probably the important part for the flavor, or a very important part for the flavor profile.
Exactly. And also it amazes me how people can say, well, it's alcohol free. I'm selling an alcohol free wine, or I'm selling alcohol beer, or an alcohol free gin. And it's never been an actual gin. It's either been, if we're looking at gins, it's either been water with botanicals added to it, or flavorings in other spirits, or wines that take the grape juice. Say like in South Africa, they can take the Pinot Noir and use the grape must and the grape flavors, the juices, and they call it an alcohol-free beverage. But not an actual wine, because it's not being fermented into producing a wine. Our products are actual wines that have then been de-alkalized, so giving it the full flavor and the full body. Which also then goes into a double manufacturing in process. So when people say, well, why are your products expensive? That is the reason why. It isn't, you know, an adult drink that's just been made up of sugars and flavorings. It is actually produced as you would produce a sparkling wine.
Yeah, but a lot of people don't understand why wine costs what it does. And actually, here's an interesting one. In the UK, I mean, I saw a diagrammatical breakdown of the cost of wine and why a £10 bottle of wine isn't, in fact, twice a £5 bottle of wine because of the massive amounts of duty. And I thought that was really fascinating. So, I mean, a £10 bottle of wine is, in fact, you know, say £4.60 of duty, whatever it is. Say a £5 bottle of wine is a 40p bottle of wine.
In some cases. And also then you're going to get some of your listeners that will say, well, hang on a minute, there is no duty on alcohol free. So yeah, no, there is no duty. But obviously, we've got the cost of the double cost of producing the wine, then de-alkalizing the wine, and then still shipping it over, which is astronomical now, trying to import products from Europe since we've gone into Brexit.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because we had a guy on from the number one gambling expo in the gambling industry. And he told us, and I think maybe he needs to have a word with your import guys, that businesses bringing stuff in for the expo from Europe would definitely have no additional costs. So, you know, he obviously knows what he's talking about. And I think you might need to have a word with your accountants. I think they're swizzing you there.
It's since the beginning of the year, we've all seen prices increase here in the UK. So we know that our costs have all gone up, certainly with fuel prices. And we've got that being added on from bringing it over from Europe and into the UK. So yes, costs have definitely gone up. Everything's gone up, and we're all feeling the pinch. When we actually present our products to some of the supermarkets, it's us, the producers, that pay for those promotions that are done within store. It's not your big supermarkets that put the promotions on. So they're still in a win-win. It's us as the manufacturers and suppliers that have to take the hit on reducing our prices for the benefit of the consumers.
I can put you in touch with the guy from Clarion, because he clearly knows something your guys don't. or maybe he was deluded. It's hard to say for sure. So I'm going to assume your company's quite young, right?
Very young, yes.
So I'm going to assume that this isn't your concept, but that this is it safe to say this is not your de-alcoholizing the wine. It's not your concept, and that this is kind of is this a growing sector, like worldwide, not just in the UK?
It is a huge sector, a growing sector as well. We haven't in the UK jumped on the bandwagon the same as our cousins over in Australia, Canada, and America. What I can tell you of some feedback that has been given to me is that 37% of consumers drink alcohol-free at home at least once a week. This was in the Low and No Report 2022.
Does that include water?
This is actually low, no alcohol, not water. So this is what they're drinking at home. And it's also
37%?
Yes. Yeah. This is how big this sector is growing, John. It's going to be absolutely huge. Who would have thought?
I find 37% staggeringly high.
Well, it's also interesting to note that 55% of all UK consumers are reducing their alcohol intake.
It's, you know, if you look at, like, comparing alcohol to when I was a kid or when I started drinking, I would go into a pub, I live in the country. I'd go into a pub, any pub in the town that I grew up in, and they would all have bitters that were about 3%. And they would all have lagers that were about 3%. Mm-hmm. You cannot go into a pub now and find bitters or lagers that are under 5%. Everything seems to be designed to fuck you up as fast as it can. And it's a shit term usually used by shit people, but there is no such thing as a session beer now. And I always liken it to marijuana, because when I was a kid, you used to be able to smoke all friggin' day and just, you know, have a perfectly happy time with your mates. And now everything is skunk, everything is super, super strength, and everything is designed to absolutely knock your head off. And it's a very, very similar thing. And it's kind of, you know, you kind of praise both the marijuana and alcohol industries for their efficiency drive. But at the same time, you know.
It's interesting you say that on our generation. I mean, we were brought up that, you know, when we went out to the pub, it was in two sessions. And how we, you know, our lovely culture here in the UK became binge drinkers, because we knew that the bell would ring at 10 to 11 and you'd get your last orders in with three or four pints of how quick you could net back down. That's all changed, obviously, now, but now that we have our extended in licensing hours. But also the young generation, the millennials and the Z generation, are either drinking certainly a lot less than we did when we used to go out when we were 18, or not drinking at all. And the reason why I wanted to launch Prohibition Wine Company was because I still wanted to go out drinking through the week or at lunchtime with my friends or for business. But it's that experience, it's that holding that glass, the correct glass, with either with a glass of alcohol-free wine in it, or as I, if I can't get alcohol-free wine when I go to a restaurant or a bar, I will ask for them to put a tonic water into a wine glass, so it feels as though I'm still drinking, I'm still an adult, rather than having a horrible water tumbler given to me and I'm being offered a Coke or an orange juice or, sparkling or still water.
I do quite like sparkling water, though.
Oh, well, we all like sparkling water, but there's only so much you can drink, John, through the day.
We say that. I'm going to reveal something to you now, Julia. I only drink water.
But does it have anything added to it?
Nope.
Oh, well, there we go.
And for nearly 5 years now, I've only drunk water.
Well, that's good.
Well, you know what? I look like a teenager.
Well, there we go.
A really old teenager. Like a teenager that's had a really hard life and has probably spent most of their life drinking cider. We did have a chat before we started recording. And when we were chatting before we started recording, I said to you, why did you start the company? Because quite often companies like this start because of harm. And that's 100% not what you've done. And you just touched on it just now that the Prohibition Wine Company started because you wanted a grown-up alternative that tasted good, would, you know, looked and acts and tastes exactly like an alcoholic drink. And I think it's, I mean, I can't wait to try it. And I totally think you should send me some.
Most definitely.
I'm just fucking with you, honestly. it sounds brilliant. But particularly, and part of the reason that I wanted to get you on the podcast is because, you know, we have a lot of senior management, we have a lot of board level people from gambling companies worldwide on here. And the potential to have an alcohol-free wine with a really, really excellent meal is not an experience you can have in a lot of restaurants.
Thank you for bringing that up, John. That's one of another reason. So I drove 25 miles and my friend drove 25 miles. We were going to a Michelin star restaurant right on the seafront. Excellent food in there, you know, local food, nice fish. And so we turn up and say, oh, can we have a look at your alcohol-free menu, please? We can offer you a lager. Okay, or we can offer you sparkling or still water or a non-alcohol, you know, a beverage of, say, like an elderflower press. So I said, well, do you not get asked? Oh, no, we have no call for this. Now, sat behind us, John, was a lady of ladies, five ladies, and they were drinking carafe of water, just normal tap water. Do the hospitality industry not realise what the upsell is on that and what, you know, what revenue they're actually losing when people go out to have a nice meal? I mean, again, it's wanting that experience. If I'm going into, any restaurant, but let's touch on the Michelin star. If I'm going in paying for that experience and that amount of money, why am I not able to get a wine pairing with that meal? The couple that sat next to us, he was having a steak and it was like, oh, there was a nice red wine to go with this. We sit there and want a fish. Oh, you can have orange juice or Coke. Where's the experience there? I might as well have just nipped down to McDonald's and I'm sure they would have offered me something better and said we can pair something.
But also, given the complexity of a dish in a Michelin-starred restaurant, why on earth would you offer somebody a non-alcoholic solution? Fucking orange juice.
I know.
Well, let's just pillage your taste buds while we're here.
Well, I don't drink a Coke at home and I only have orange juice when I'm having my breakfast. So I wouldn't be wanting it with my main, you know, with whether it's a lunchtime or an evening meal, that I'm out there to have an experience that what you want, like you're saying, you want the complexity. You want to be able to sit there and you've got your nice wine. And they enhance each other. And you walk out there going, you know, that was an amazing experience. We walked out of there, my friend and I, and went, do you know what? We won't be going back there again. Not until they have alcohol-free wine anyway.
I went to a restaurant in Macau. For anybody listening in that region, I was with a guy called Paulo Azevedo, who had the most tremendous selection of hats. And we went out to dinner. It was a beautiful restaurant. I mean, it was one of those restaurants where I know I don't belong. I'm not being modest. I don't belong there. And it had been a really long day. And they do a beautiful beer in Macau called Macau Beer. I guess it's named after where it's from.
Mm-hmm.
And they had it in bottles. And I'm like, I just said to the guy, just keep them coming. That'd be great. Thanks. And I had this beautiful meal. And I realized that my publisher and Paolo had both had loads of different wines. And I'm like, how come? And they're like, oh, well, did you not see? It's a tasting menu and you should be having this wine with this dish. And I'm like, I'm just caning these beers back when I still drank. I don't drink anymore. And I felt like a bit of a prune because I knew straight away I had missed out on something that had been very specifically paired. And as a complimentary enhancement to the meal and to almost even to further complexify the profile of the meal. And I felt like a bit of a dick. I mean, it was really tasty beer, don't get me wrong. I'm not actually complaining, but I did realize, yeah, I've done this badly wrong. Is it difficult doing what you're doing? I mean, it must be. How'd you get the drink? Because, I mean, you can get somebody to taste something, but if they're not the right person, they're not going to order it.
No, it is very difficult. We're a growing band of businesses. And obviously, for the fact that we've got the likes of Guinness who do a zero Guinness, they must see that there is opportunities there. We've also got the big boys over in Australia now starting to produce alcohol-free wines. It's... You know, the way I compare it at the moment when talking to people is, would you have thought even sort of like 2 years ago that you would see advertised as you're driving down the street a Mac Plant burger? And that's where we are at the moment with alcohol-free wines. We will get there. There's many of us out there pushing it. And there's some amazing brands out there. It is getting people to taste it. And to explain to them if there is a price cost of how that price cost has come about. But also it's about an alternative lifestyle that, you know, I don't drink or try not to drink through the week. But if I'm watching a football match through the week, I like to have that glass in my hand and think I'm taking part. And then I can still drink at the weekends. What we are finding is that once people do start to taste the quality wines and the quality beers and lagers and spirits that are out there, then they can interact with you know, an alternative, so that they can, if they want to, have one or two glasses of alcohol when they go out, but then switch, knowing that they know what is on offer at a good quality. And it's getting the hospitality industry, like we've just discussed about Michelin star restaurants. I have actually got in September, the end of September, I've been working with a hotel group that's based down in the southwest of England. And I sat down with the head chef and we spent an hour and a half doing tastings with my wines. And we've put a menu together and we're going to be launching that at the end of September in one of their hotels. And it's an invite event for people to come to. And they'll be able to then understand the complexity of the wines. And we're not only doing wines, we're doing wines, we're doing spirits. And being able to say, look, right, we'll start the evening off with, in inverted commas, an Aperol spritz. Then we'll move on into something else and take it that way. So again, like you were saying, when you were out in the restaurant, different food to go with a different alcohol-free product, so that people will go, do you know what? I've had a fantastic experience. And the other thing as well, John, is one of my friends, he's a biochemist and he has got a alcohol-free company as well. And they have done research and they actually filmed 50 people. 25 of them knew they were going to be, they didn't know what they were going to be drinking, but 25 knew they were going to have alcohol and 25 knew they were going to have non-alcohol, but they didn't know who, what was, who was going to get. But when they were actually doing the filming, everybody behaved in exactly the same way. Some of the people who actually had drank non-alcohol products still had that buzz and still and thought they had been drinking alcohol. It's that, it's going back to that experience. It's having the right glass. It's being in that environment. It's taking part in being with your family, friends, colleagues, whoever that you're out with, and just having a really good time. But you don't have to drink alcohol to do that.
I think, I'm not trying to, do any what about. I just, this is just something I believe personally. I do most of my work, almost all of my work in the gambling industry. And I see an industry that's full of very, very intelligent people, people that are passionate about what they do, people that, you know, love a challenge, people that are in hospitality, and offering entertainment fundamentally. And very often the gambling industry is painted as a demon. And sometimes there is shitty behavior, but there is shitty behavior all around us. It's not because it's the gambling industry. But I've seen very, very often talk about the immense harm done by problem gambling within society. And there's no denying the harm that can happen when it's not monitored properly, when there are not interventions, when people aren't just looked after fundamentally. But I do believe that the social issues that come from alcohol are greater than almost anything else in society. And so when I see an option like yours, something that gives somebody a perfectly socially acceptable way of being out and about and drinking less or not drinking at all, I'm totally for it, because it's like, here's something, right? And I might be statistically wrong here. I might have my figures slightly askew. But if I remember correctly, there are 5 cancers in women that are directly attributed, as in there is a causal link with drinking alcohol. You don't see that warning on a fucking wine bottle, do you? And yet the NHS has to pay for that. That's not something that's commonly known. The information is out there, but unlike a cigarette packet, that doesn't have to be on a wine bottle. And I find that pretty annoying, because you want people to make an informed choice, to trust them to be adults and to make their decision with all the information that's available. And actually, I find that really annoying. Sorry, I went a bit crusady there. Whew. Sorry about that. I'll go, you know, normal service will be resumed. Sporting tech, woo!
I think you will find, though, John, they have put on the back of alcohol products now about the awareness, drink awareness. There is that now on the labelling, and there also is the logo there for non-drinking while pregnant. But as you say, I think it's at the end of the day, on anything that you're looking at, whether it be gambling or whether it be drinking, it's education. It's starting with the younger generation of educating within the schools. You know, it's the same, dare we say, we digress and we go on to obesity. You know, when I was at school, we did physical education every single day of the week. And at weekends as well, if you were in the teams at school, you then went off playing your hockey, your netball, or whatever at the weekends. That now, you know, has just disappeared. I'm lucky if my grandchildren do one sporting activity a week, and it all comes down to education. You know, we need to get the education into the schools and the colleges. We need to educate them again about with the students that are at in the hospitality industry that are doing catering courses, teach them that they can learn about introducing alcohol-free products into their menus, into their recipes. They don't have to use an alcohol product. So it's again, it's educating from a young age, and then for them as the children to go back to the parents and educate the parents, because I think sometimes that's the biggest form of learning, is that the adults have got into very bad habits, and if the child starts to say to them, look, mom, dad, I think we should look at this issue, we've been learning about this, and then taking an interest in it and making them want to understand more about what is actually happening out there in the big wide world.
There is an issue with education, though.
Mm-hmm.
And this, I just finished a book about this a few days ago, and this book blew my mind. And no word of a lie, absolutely blew my mind. And it's another one of those that this information is out there. Why aren't we all told this? Okay, so I just finished a book called The Big Fat Surprise. And it's a big piece of work. It's not a huge book. It's very closely typeset, though. It's definitely one for your reading glasses. Anybody out there that's about my age? The book is about the demonization of saturated fats and what's happened socially as a result of that demonization, and where the idea came from that saturated fats are bad for us, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it goes from the 1950s up to the present day. And it deconstructs all of the major studies and explains what's wrong with them. And in some cases, where they actually just omitted information. And basically everything that we think we know about eating healthily, turns out it's all bollocks. And it comes from one guy, a nutritionist in the US called Ansel Keys. And Keys shouted very loudly and had the right people's ears. And so if you say to somebody, well, if you eat fat, you'll get fat, it makes a really simplistic logic, right? It makes sense, doesn't it?
You would have thought.
Yeah, but it's absolute bollocks. If you eat fat, you get heart disease. Turns out that's bollocks too. So we've all been going along eating these diets that are low in fat, higher in carbohydrate. And that's the root cause of the problem. And the root cause, I mean, the leap in diabetes, type 2 diabetes, we're talking about diseases that either didn't exist in their numbers or didn't exist in certain populations at all until they're exposed to essentially what you might simplistically call a Western diet. Once they're exposed to sugar and carbohydrates and the fats in their diet come down, they start experiencing heart disease in massive numbers. And so all these things that we've been educated about, and this journalist does a tremendous job of going through it pretty much chronologically, breaking down the data and saying, this is what's wrong. This is why it's wrong. This is why they presented this. This is who funded their report. This is where the money came from. And it's not in a conspiracy theory way. It's just eat more saturated fats. You'll probably live longer and have a better quality of life. We were lied to. So with education, the tricky part is there is very often a vested interest somewhere down the line in making things happen. And unfortunately, I think as people, as society, as a community, we have this belief that people are acting in our best interests. And unfortunately, they're generally really not. Maybe I'm just being super philosophical. Today is actually my birthday.
Oh, happy birthday, John.
Maybe I'm just depressed, Julia. I'm not depressed. It was a really great book, but it was just an example of how one person shouting loudly about a massively flawed initial study. It was called something like the Seven Nations Study, and he basically took heart disease information from seven countries and said, look at how much fat they eat. Ooh, is there, that's caused that. The initial study was actually 30 odd countries, and he just left the other 23 that didn't fit with his theory out. And that study became the basis for everything that we have in modern nutrition. That's insane. But anyway, whew, sorry. But you're right. It starts with education. It starts with education that comes from the right place. Doing something because it's the right thing to do and because it's with the best information that we have.
And that comes down to choice, John, so that when you do go out to eat or you go out for a drink, that you have this choice for you to choose of what you would like to drink. I mean, there's new laws coming in now that all menus have to have calorific values on their for their each course and what's on their menu. And the same with the alcohol and non-alcohol products, that all has to be there. The interesting fact about alcohol-free our wine is that it has got less sugar in it, so it's low in calories. So you can actually have, you could drink a full bottle of alcohol-free wine for the equivalent of a 250ml normal glass of wine that you would get when you go out to a bar or restaurant.
Amazing, because I mean, alcoholic drinks are a massive source of sugar, as I learned myself when I quit drinking and suddenly started pushing chocolate into my mouth whenever it was open. And it's really, I was reading a book, this was a while ago, about the effects of gluten on the brain. It's written by an American neurologist. And it had this, it was just one sentence in the book, and it just said, people who drink a lot, you know, generally don't think they have a sweet tooth, but that's because all their sugar is in the alcohol they drink. And I sort of, it stuck in the back of my head. And then when I quit drinking, I'm like, holy shit. Well, they were completely correct. But it's a massive amount, it's a massive source of calories for people as well.
Well, that's it. And that's why when people cut out alcohol, they start to lose weight.
But that thing about labeling menus with calorie counts, again, it's, that's not the important figure. That's not the important thing on there. Sure, you can limit your calories, but that's not a long-term solution. The long-term solution is to educate about the actual content of the food. And, you know, the traffic light system in the UK, red is a bad amount of whatever. Amber is a so-so amount of whatever. And green, go for it. You very rarely see reds on the sugars and on the carbohydrates, and that's where it should be. You see red on the fat all the time. It just does my noggin in.
But it's not educating either, John, either. You know,
it's perpetuating.
I mean, when I was at school, it was calorie counting, and you knew you could intake so many calories, and you had to exert so many calories. And if you didn't exert over the amount of calories that you had eaten, then you knew you were going to put on weight. And this is what the education has changed in, that we've become, we're gently eradicating what we learnt sort of like from the 70s and 80s of doing that, and also taking in. I mean, they should be telling people that this Mars bar that has 250 calories in it, how much exercise you have to do to burn that up. And they don't, and that would be so much easier and simpler to explain to people. You know, I went and did a 4.5 mile run this morning, and that burnt 360 calories. So, I mean, you know, but then you'd go and buy you'd eat a burger from McDonald's that would be the equivalent of that. So it's, you've got to explain to people how much energy you've got to exert, how much exercise you've got to do. You know, people think, oh, I'll go to the gym, I'll go for a half an hour walk. What is the equivalent of half an hour walk? You know, it's educating them on that side, that this is how much they can take into the body, and how much they should be eating, and how much they exert. And again, it comes down to everything in moderation, and whether that be gambling, whether that be eating, or whether that be drinking. If we all take things in moderation, then we would be much better off.
It's hard to argue. But I say that just because I'm not an argumentative person. Julia, thank you very much for joining us. And I wish you great luck with... I haven't asked you all of my questions.
Go on.
The selection of wines that the Prohibition Wine Company does, what is your actual wine selection?
So currently we have got a sparkling rosé and a sparkling white, and we are just working on profiles for a still rosé, a still white and a red wine. So those will be available towards the end of this year, but currently it's sparkling rosé and sparkling white.
Okay. Of your selection, what's your favourite? But also generally in the world of wines, what are your favourites?
Oh, in the world of wines of a alcohol side, I'm a Viognier for the white. And for red, for a red, I would say an Amarone. And then my favourite, well, I like both my wines. I think they're both excellent tasting. But I tend to go for the rosé.
Okay. What grape is the rosé from?
It's a Temperano.
Okay.
And so it's 100%, and the white is 100% Aryan.
So I always think that when you buy a gift for somebody, it should be something personal. So when I buy somebody wine, I buy my favourite wine.
Yes.
And just go, there you go, try that. And they'll be like, that's fucking horrible. Why would you do that to me? But actually, my favourite red was always Carmenere, which from not being able to find anywhere, suddenly you can find in quite a few places now, which is always a real treat. And my favourite white, I think, probably, and this, you don't see this in a lot of places, and you often see it as a dessert wine, which is a travesty in my humble opinion, Gewürztraminer.
Oh, yes. Yes.
But
very
when
nice.
when you have it non-dessert, and it's just like, it has, and I always say, I give this to people, I say, try that. When you drink it, tell me what the finish is. And they always say the same thing. Holy shit, that's lychees.
Yes.
And it is. It's like you've actually put a lychee in your mouth and chewed it. Ah, it's extraordinary. It's fabulous.
You're saying it as a dessert wine. I also like it with fish as well, with a light fish.
Definitely.
Think it enhances place really, really nice.
I've had it even with something that's a bit more dense. I think I had it with some cobbler or something like that. Well, what's that Australian one? Can't remember the name. They were trying to replace cod with it in the UK.
Oh, Pollock.
No, Barramundi maybe. Oh. And it's like it's quite a full flavoured. It does work really well with fish, Gewürztraminer. I'm a big, big fan. Have you watched anything good on Netflix lately?
Oh, huge Netflix fan. I've suddenly got into box sets, so it's been whatever's been on Netflix for box sets. I've run out now. I'm waiting for New Vikings. What else have I been watching? Oh, Breeders, that's a good one as well, but I think that's on normal TV. Oh, I can't remember. We've got so much on the TV now, I don't know whether it's on Netflix or not. So, but
Julia,
Game of Thrones. Oh.
Julia. The key question we ask everybody that comes on here, have you seen Cobra Kai?
Yes.
Do you like it?
Yes, very good. Amazing.
Fintan, I hope you're listening. Fintan's my usual co-host. He's on holiday in Australia, living his best life. But our straw poll it's not done well, Cobra Kai. I'm just in the process of finishing. I might finish it tonight. I might not. The Queen's Gambit.
Oh no, not seen that one.
Okay, it's on Netflix. I say without reservation, go watch it.
It's bookmarked.
It's excellent. It's genuinely excellent. Yeah, it's been a real treat. It's only 7 episodes. I don't see how you could ever make a second season. So it's just a limited series of seven. And it's beautiful to look at. It's, yeah, it's peculiar, but it's really, really good. But I'm glad you like a bit of Netflix. I'm just chasing Netflix for sponsorship. But anyway, that is me out of questions, I think. Yeah, that's got to be it. Julia, thank you so much for joining us. I do wish you the very best of luck with the company. And if anybody from the casino industry is listening to this and getting into their heads, do you know what? A grown-up alternative would be a really great thing. And it's another marketing tool for the casino bar. And it's just win-win. So Julia is findable as Julia Wilson on LinkedIn. Or obviously you can drop me a line and I'd be happy to put anybody in contact. So Julia, thank you.
Thank you, John.
We move swiftly on to our celebrated award-winning, probably, and if they haven't won any yet, I'm just being prescient, final guest, the excellent Sharon Singleton and Roz Wade of AG Brief, Asia Gamer Brief. Hello.
Asia Gaming Brief.
That's what I said. I did, but statistically speaking, I was bound to get it right one day. but welcome, and no Fenton here. So, I mean, it's, you know, it's a bit more relaxed.
Well, thanks for having us again, John.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming back. And relatively soon after your last appearance, so I'm sorry to bother you with this, but there's not a lot of things happening all over the place, but I wanted to talk about Macau because it's all kicked off again.
Ugh.
Poor things.
Or not.
Or hasn't kicked off, yes.
Yeah.
But I think last time we were talking, I think, Sharon, you said, like, look, it costs X amount just for these casinos to exist per day.
Yes.
And they're currently spunking that, I think it's fair to say.
Well, they are probably quite delighted at the moment because, as you know, the government has announced that they are all to be closed for a week from Monday. The word on the ground, I've just been told, is that most people there think that that will be extended for another week. And the point is, once the casinos are closed, it's a force majeure type of situation, which means they don't have to pay their staff. And so that's already a fairly major cost saving for them on the considerable operating expenditures, which is well over $1 million a day.
Yes, I think I was reading as well, you know, some of the casino workers that over the last couple of years, they keep being asked to go on no pay leave. Although I think this is the first time the casinos have actually been closed, is it, in the last couple of years? It's February 2020, Sharon. But
this is the first time they've actually been closed. since the beginning. Mm.
This one chap, you know, I think he was, I can't remember what he was, a dealer perhaps, but on a quarter of the salary he had been on. So how these people are surviving, I don't know.
Yes, I think the government has been quite supportive, but there's only so far that they can go. It's very difficult to see how long this is going to go on for. I mean, people think that the actual lockdown will last for another week at least after this initial week. People aren't allowed out unless they're going to the supermarket or for medical purposes. You know, they're even stopping people walking their dogs or anybody out for a walk. That's no longer allowed. That's something that they are punishing, actually. And
not wearing the correct mask, right?
And not wearing the correct mask. And people think that, you know, even if the casinos reopen at the end of 2 weeks, that it's going to be well into September before there's any really return to normality in Macau.
So, yeah, I think the analysts are saying they have to write off July, obviously, and probably August as well, which means there is no more, you know, no blue sky for casinos anyway. And when you say, yes, you know, the government's being generous, but 80% of their revenue is from casinos too. So I suppose they have fairly fat coffers, but even so.
Yes, they do. It's just hard to see where they will basically learn to live with the virus like everybody else in the world. You know, Macau is over 90% vaccinated. Unfortunately, they have very poor medical facilities. They've just got one hospital for all of their population, which is about 650 million, thousand, somewhere around there. And so, yes, they're really already creaking, even on a daily basis, to cope with cases pre-COVID. So if they had a massive influx of COVID cases, they would be in severe trouble.
Should we talk a little bit about what they mean by dynamic zero COVID? What is this dynamic zero?
I think it means that they will not reopen while there is community transmission, which means that they have cases that are circulating that they're not quite sure where they've come from. And obviously they've been sampling and testing and sampling, and anybody who's suspected to have been in close contact with people who were positives have all now been put in quarantine hotels. And some of those hotels are getting quite nice now, I have to say.
Nice. More from Broadway and Studio City.
Exactly. Nice. We've got the Grand Hyatt in the City of Dreams complex. In fact, you know, quite a good number of these luxury hotels now have been roped in, and all of those people are under sort of medical supervision. So if they carry on testing positive, that's kind of okay because they've got them under lock and key and they're not wandering around the community. But they're worried about those ones that they're still getting on a daily basis, which are found just randomly in the community.
So I saw somewhere that there's over 4,500 people in isolation at the moment, hotel isolation.
Yes, I believe that's probably, I haven't looked at the figures this morning, but it's a huge number of people, huge numbers. I mean, it's really rather a crazy situation. Of course, the borders with China are also, they're not shut. You can go, but if you enter China from Macau now, you've got 7 days mandatory quarantine in a hotel in China. So, of course, nobody would be coming to Macau, even if the casinos do reopen under those kind of circumstances. So it's, it's hard to see how this is going to end.
Well, this is it. I mean, we can debate whether you can actually beat COVID, you know, into submission, into zero, which we're not medical experts, so we can't comment on that. But I think, you know, the wider question is, you know, what's the fate of Macau going forwards? You know, I think an South China Morning Post article was saying, have the glory days ended? But this is one thing. But then, of course, you've got all the concession renewals, you know, the junket issues, what have you. I mean, what do you see as being, has it lost its crown? You know, will it ever regain it?
I think that's a really good question, Ros. And I think that's the multi-million dollar question. I mean, my other feeling with this is that COVID, while we've got this zero COVID policy and COVID is so badly hitting visitation to Macau, we're not going to really see the full impact of China's policies. We don't know, you know, really quite how bad the collapse of the junket industry is. We won't know, you know, all of this anecdotal evidence that we've heard of China basically refusing visas to frequent travelers to Macau who are thought to be some of the premium gamblers who are coming in. We won't really know until COVID stops clouding the overall picture just how much of an impact that will be and how much Beijing will tolerate in form of gaming in Macau. So, yeah, it's hard to tell at the moment. And as you mentioned, quite rightly, in this context, with practically zero revenue, incredible uncertainties over the future size of the market due to China's policies, the concessionaires are being asked to put forward investment proposals to the government for how much they're willing to spend in Macau in return for their new license, and in particular, how much they're spending on non-gaming facilities, which have always been loss leaders.
I wish them luck with that.
And attracting foreign visitors.
Yes.
Although you've got to say that in terms of attracting non-Chinese visitors, Macau, I mean, that's improved a lot in the last sort of 5 to 8 years. I know the last time I was there, admittedly, a couple of years ago now, But there were loads more Australians there. There were loads more Indian tourists, more Japanese tourists as well, which was a real surprise. So, I mean, that's sort of evolving, was evolving naturally.
It's still an absolute drop in the bucket, though, compared with mainland Chinese, both in terms of actual visitation and casino spending. It just
and then what about, you know, people, I think, you know, the other side of the coin is of course, expats working there and whether they're all leaving in droves. Same as in Hong Kong, there's a bit of a brain drain going on. And I think it's the same with, you know, obviously senior casino management.
Exactly. We saw two depart from Wynn Resorts, Wynn Macau, in the last 10 days or so. There is anecdotal evidence of quite a few people who've been locked down, some of the big suppliers, key members of staff, who, if they've not left for good, they have basically left to go on tour. Let's just put it that way. For a few months, because obviously they've been unable to see their customers for years now. And a lot of people have just had enough. They're just leaving.
Yeah, I've had enough. Do you think there's an argument in all this, not just for Macau, but do you think there's an argument for a slight rethink in tax collection and how it works, in that you might say, let's also stick X percentage of this aside for want of a better expression, for a rainy day fund?
Well, they do that. They do, you know, there are certain...
Well, they just not looked out the window yet. And it's definitely raining.
Yeah, no, they have a sovereign wealth fund, I believe. And they also have, of that 39% tax on gross gaming revenue, there are... certain, I can't remember the exact breakdown now, but there is a certain percentage that goes towards, you know, various community funds and things like that. But if the question is, could they have perhaps spent their lovely gaming lolly more wisely? Yeah, they probably could have done. I mean, the infrastructure is not good enough in Macau. I mean, we were just talking about hospitals, one hospital for 650,000 people, or however many there are. You know, the transportation facilities are minimal. They only recently opened the, you know, the subway link. You talk to anybody in Macau and they will moan on about how the infrastructure there really badly needs an overhaul. And yet the government's really not invested in doing that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think with the transportation, even though all non-essential businesses are closed, people are still struggling with how to get to work. I'm not sure whether they have these permits they're supposed to use on the public transport, but just, you know, nothing's working.
Yeah.
So, yeah, infrastructure-wise, it's never been up to par, really.
No, it hasn't.
It is making the British government response and all of that look really good. at the moment, I never thought I'd say that.
Quite a feat.
Yeah. Jesus.
I just, you know, it depends. I mean, Macau has only had two deaths from COVID, and I've lost count in the UK. I mean, countless more people than anywhere else in Europe died, I think. So before we give
if you want to be picky... Then, if you want to look at that as a metric, but we're not looking at that as a metric.
Oh, we're not.
Mind you, one hospital for 650,000 people, it's starting to sound like Shropshire.
Yeah, it's not, you know.
I have to travel, when I was living in Ludlow, I had to travel at least 45 minutes to an hour to get to an A&E.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think Macau should look at that and they should just think, well, at least we're not in Shropshire.
Yeah.
It's all relative. But, yeah, I see what you're saying about deaths. Some people do think that is one of the important measurements. But
there is a certain point where, you know, I think a lot of the small businesses, they, at the end of the day... they're saying, well, you know, what about us? Our deaths, there's a death of the local economy. You know, we talk about the operators all the time because that's our focus. But at the end of the day, you know, they're all of those small suppliers who basically earn their living as periphery service providers, or rely on the visitation coming to some of the casinos. They're all really struggling. I can't remember the numbers of how many are going out of business. Are really quite extraordinary. I'm just like looking up the hospitals in Macau here again, because I just suddenly thought, I'll just double check that. There's one public hospital. There are a couple of privates, two privates listed.
I'm sure they're chipping in and helping.
Yeah.
Because that's how private hospitals work. Yes. They're usually staffed by people from the public hospitals, and the people have trained in the public hospitals, and they make their retirement funds from their consultancy work at the private hospitals. That's certainly how it works with the NHS and private hospitals in the UK.
Yeah.
Yeah. My bestie from school trained as a psychologist on the NHS, and out of her class intake of 30 odd, where the NHS paid for all of their training.
Yeah.
She's the only one that actually stayed to work in the NHS.
Wow.
Now, I don't know about you, but I would be embarrassed to even tell anybody that I'd done that. Because that just looks like theft to me. But then, you know, people are twats. Have you two watched anything on Netflix recently?
No, I just started watching.
Well, yes, run out of things to watch, actually. So just started watching The Holiday, and then Maid, which is very depressing. But good things, can't really remember.
Summer in Spain. It's TV sort of not so much on the radar.
Imagine TV is probably melting at the moment.
Exactly.
I'm just watching The Queen's Gambit.
Oh, that's excellent.
I've seen that. It's good.
Yeah, it's very, very good. Yeah. Really lovely surprise. But I was saying to, I think I was saying to another guest on this very episode, it's kind of, so I've read some Walter Tevis books in the past, as many people have, because he wrote The Hustler and The Color of Money. And it's a similar thing to The Hustler, where you've got kind of, it's almost a study of genius and, or rather a study of dysfunctional genius, rather. In a similar-ish sort of way, because The Color of Money and The Hustler are both, you know, a guy who's super, super smart at what he does, but just makes really shitty choices quite often.
A bit like us.
Yeah.
All of us, I think that applies, and we can say that because Fintan's not here. If Fintan was here, it would be like if we were representative of the population, 75% of the population. But no, I'm just kidding, because I think you two have probably made great choices. And
coming on this podcast for one.
Well, that's, you know, amazing. We are sponsored now.
Are you indeed? Congratulations.
I know. And we've got some theme music coming, which I'm very excited about.
Have you written the theme tune, sung the theme tune?
I see what you did there. And no, so do you remember a bunch of years ago, there was an IKEA advert with some cats being poured through a ceiling into an IKEA store?
No.
Well, it's a very good advert. Well, a mate of mine from sixth form, they used one of her songs for that.
Cool.
And so I asked her if she would do something for us. And she was like, I'm just really busy. She said, but I own all the publishing for my music. So if you want to use something I've already done, crack on. So we're just sorting that out at the moment. So that's pretty exciting. And you could not think of a less gambling industry musician. If you know, she plays the saw.
The what?
Saw.
Don't even know what that is, I'm afraid.
It's an implement usually used for cutting stuff. Yeah.
Oh, that kind of saw.
You can get like a toothless variety of it and you play it with a bow.
Right.
And it is bonkers.
Bonkers.
In fact, her first song on her first album is her voice and saw. It's brilliant. Anyway, sorry. But sponsors, right? Sponsors. We've got, like, if I were rating my top iGaming platform providers, I would almost certainly have Sporting Tech at number one.
Well, yes, I should say so.
I mean, I think so. Sharon, I don't know if you've got an opinion on top iGaming platform providers.
Is this the one that's sponsoring you?
Yeah.
Previously Pronet.
The very same.
Oh.
I think they're marvellous.
I thought they were still called Pronet, are they not?
Well, there's a repositioning. And they're basically going to make sporting tech what Pronet became while Pronet does something else. It's do you know what? They have so many clever people in the organization that it's above my head what they're doing. It's kind of totally over my head. So wow. I'm just going to assume, you know, like when I go into surgery, I don't second guess the surgeon. I'm just going to look at them and say, do you know what, lads? That looks good.
And plus they're sponsoring you, so...
But you know, I've hardly given that a moment's thought. But I've got some nice things planned because they said I can do whatever I want for their spots, like this, bring it up in conversation now. And I'm like, are you sure about this? And they're like, no, go for it. So I've got something planned for the intro of this episode, which is going to be a bit weird because when you're listening to this episode and it has this bit in it, you already have heard that. It's going to feel like a really bad Terminator film, which is all of them after Terminator 2. But anyway, Sharon, Roz.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
It's our pleasure.
Thank you so much.
We'll see you next time something else disastrous happens in Asia.
So probably next week?
Yeah, quite soon. Yeah. If you've enjoyed this episode of the Gambling Files podcast, please find us on LinkedIn under the name The Gambling Files Podcast. Find us on Twitter. What's her name on Twitter? I think it's just at Gambling Files. Find the website where you can sign up for an email that we never send, which is www.thegamblingfiles.com. And most importantly, share the podcast. Tell people about it, share it on social media, tell your colleagues. If you want to come on or if there's somebody that you'd like to see come on as a guest, then please let us know. We're receptive. Did I mention that we're sponsored by Sporting Tech? I meant to.